This is Professor J.D., and finishing up is Stephen Wilson from album To the Bone, song Permeating, a concert hit on his current world tour, which stops in Asheville on December 8th. The Orange Peel will host the 2018 winner of UK Artist of the Year at the Progressive Music Awards. Stephen Wilson is with me now via telephone. How are you today, sir?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay. Now, I'll first disclose I'm a longtime fan and own most of your discography, including Porcupine Tree and other bands and collaborations, and many of your remixes, but we are here today to talk primarily about your solo career and specifically your latest album, To the Bone. First question, what is the difference being part of a band like Porcupine Tree or a collaboration and being a solo artist with a band?
That's a good question. The answer is it's quite nebulous in a way, because Porcupine Tree obviously was a solo project when it started. The first three albums that I made under that name were just me in my bedroom at my parents' house where I was growing up making music. And I guess at that time I didn't necessarily have the confidence to just put it out under my own name. So I invented this kind of, at the time I was just kind of having fun. So I invented this imaginary band identity and started to release albums under that name. And then obviously later on it did become a legitimate band. I guess the difference for me is that when you're in a band, you are more constricted by, and by the way, I don't seriously think this is a bad thing. It's something that gives the band its identity, but you are, by necessity, you're more constricted by trying to find music that all members of that band will enjoy playing. So even if you're the captain of the ship, as I was, and I wrote most of the music, and I still was very much responsible for steering, you know, the band in particular directions, I was also conscious when I was steering in a direction that perhaps other members of the band weren't so thrilled about. And that's not a particularly nice feeling, you know, to be feel like you're forcing people to play music that they don't necessarily enjoy playing. So I thought to myself one day, well, why am I in this situation? I would much rather be able to change direction, make different kinds of records, work with different musicians. And in a sense, I found myself coming right back to the beginning of my career, being someone who was, you know, very much in control of their own destiny and their own sense of evolution. And I felt ultimately the Porcupine Tree had achieved what we were supposed to achieve. We kind of made, by the time we finished, we'd made 10 records, all quite different. There'd been quite a sense of evolution. But I felt also that I was beginning to paint myself into a corner. And I wanted to do different kinds of records and evolve at a quicker rate. And I think that's the answer to your question. I wanted to be able to change at a quicker rate. And if you're a solo artist, I think it's much easier to do that.
Yeah, I get it. Now, you've covered many genres in your career as a songwriter, but you are mostly known as the flag bearer of progressive music, according to Prog Magazine anyway. But generally, you're considered a prog artist, which I've read you don't necessarily agree with.
I don't really go out of my way to categorize what I do at all. I never have. I mean, I think there's a difference between being very upset about being labeled as a particular thing and being labeled at all. And I think it's the latter for me. I wouldn't be any happier if I was labeled as a metal artist or a hip hop artist or do you know what I mean? So
right.
For me, it's all about trying to be someone that is able to create their own musical world. And when I think of the artists that most inspired me growing up, Bowie, Prince, Neil Young, Frank Zappa, just to name four, these were artists that somehow seemed to exist outside of generic classification. You know, how do you describe what kind of artist is Kate Bush? What kind of artist is Neil Young? It's very hard to categorize them. And ultimately, you come back to just saying, well, they've created their own kind of musical genre, which is simply Kate Bush music or Neil Young music or Frank Zappa music or whatever. So I guess ultimately, I always wanted to be thought of as someone that had created their own musical world. And the people who kind of walk through the door into that musical world would then be introduced to all of the different aspects of what I do. And they might not necessarily like all of them. I mean, I'm a massive Zappa fan, but I don't like all of his records. But I love the fact that he made those records. And I love the fact that he did all these different things. And he was kind of beyond generic classification. He was beyond being pigeonholed. I would like to own the right to be thought of as that kind of artist. So when people say, oh, you play progressive rock, I'm not necessarily going to be terribly upset about that, but neither am I going to necessarily agree with that. And I will point to many albums in my catalogue which have precisely nothing to do with the genre of progressive rock. Albums I made as Bass Communion, albums I made that are much closer to singer-songwriter records, electronic records. So if you just choose to focus on a small portion of my catalogue, which admittedly has been the most successful portion of my catalogue, and I think that's the crux actually right there. The most successful records for me have been the ones that perhaps are closest to subscribing to whatever this idea of progressive rock is. And I acknowledge that, so it's not like I get terribly upset about it. But at the same time, I will argue, you know, my right to be thought of as someone who does a lot more than just that, if you understand what I mean.
And that's what your fans love about you. Anyway, let's talk about
you. Some of them do, and some of them don't.
You know, well, so, that's true.
Again, I think that's part of the contract that exists between someone like myself who doesn't necessarily think in terms of trying to please my existing fan base by giving them more of what they expect from me. I'm more interested in perhaps confronting what might be their expectations about what I might do. And that does, by necessity, that does inevitably lead to some people being disappointed by, you know, the directions I move in. And I've kind of got used to that over my career. It's happened many times. And certain records, I think, proved to be kind of watershed moments in my career. One, you mentioned one of them, In Absentia, which at the time, I lost a lot of fans with that record because a lot of them didn't like the embracing of a more metal element to the music. And I lost a lot of fans because they didn't like the metal direction. So I've kind of got used to it over the years. But I think what happens is as time goes on, excuse me, these records just seem to become part of my body of work. And people kind of appreciate that it is part of a sense of constantly moving and constantly trying different things. And if they don't like every single record, that's okay, because the next one will probably be to something, you know, something different again.
Right. Now, you know, talking about your latest album, To the Bone, had that kind of controversy a little bit. It's a bit of a departure for you, a nod to the 80s music you grew up with. You know, maybe some pop songs in there, but I love pop songs. Yeah, I grew up with the Beatles, and in fact, when I was a little child, the very first pop artist in the world was always playing in my house, and that was Frank Sinatra. So, you know, I appreciate pop music as much as I've read you do. So, I'm happy you did the album To the Bone. I love it. And who are some of your favorite pop artists?
Well, I think I had a similar kind of upbringing to you because my mother was a big Sinatra fan, and I still love Frank Sinatra, particularly the albums from the late 50s through to the late 60s, the sort of golden age of the Reprise albums. And I used to hear those all the time.
Huh.
But I also grew up in a house where my parents loved things like ABBA, who I still think, after the Beatles, probably the second greatest pop group of all time.
Right,
in terms of just the consistency of brilliance, if there were kind of production and the sound and the melodies and the, you know, that body of work they have is just second only to Beatles for me. Also the Carpenters. I mean, Sinatra, perhaps the greatest male singer of all time. I'd say Karen Carpenter, perhaps certainly the greatest white female voice I have ever heard, you know. So growing up with hearing music like that was very important. And then at the same time, my father was listening to the more conceptual rock music, so things like Tubular Bells and Dark Side of the Moon would also be things I would hear, along with the disco music from that era, Donna Summer, the Bee Gees, and all that stuff. So to me, well, I think it was kind of a shock to me when I went to secondary school, as we call it, in the UK, high school, as you call it, to discover that you weren't supposed to listen across genres. You were supposed to align yourself with a particular tribe, musical tribe, and and define yourself in that way. So I was kind of surprised when I went to high school and realized that actually it wasn't okay to be listening to ABBA and Pink Floyd and the Bee Gees and the Sex Pistols, because I loved it all. And I think in many ways that's kind of set the pattern for the way I think about music. And so it's always slightly surprising to me when I come up against that, what you might call a slight musical snobbery that some people apparently still have. And I have had that with To The Bone. It's not prog rock, therefore it's worthless. That kind of attitude. Or it's pop music, so therefore it's mediocre nonsense that we don't... And, you know, there's been a little bit of that, but actually I enjoy that, you know. I kind of enjoy the negative reactions to me. It almost tells me that I'm doing the right thing.
Right. Now, you stated in several interviews over the past few years that there's a difference between an artist and an entertainer. What do you mean by that?
Well, quite simply, I think an entertainer is someone that looks at what is expected of them from their fans or from the public at large, and they try to engineer what they do to fill that gap. So an entertainer would say, what can I do to please these people? Whereas an artist thinks in a completely different way, and actually it's a very selfish thing to be an artist, I believe. An artist has to be, in many respects, completely selfish about what they do. They're ultimately making something to please themselves. That's the difference for me. And being an artist is kind of vocation. It's something that comes from within. It's a need, without wishing to sound, you know, pretentious or pompous about it, but I do believe it's true. Being an artist is it's something that comes from within you. It's a need to express yourself creatively in a way that isn't compromised or tailored to please a third party, whether that's management, record company, or fan base.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between the two extremes of the industry that exist at the moment. A lot of people talk about the music industry as including things like, you know, these reality shows like X Factor and that kind of stuff. That to me is not the music industry. That's the entertainment industry. The music industry comes from people who kind of need to express themselves creatively. And sometimes those people find an audience, and you know what? Sometimes they don't. There are a lot of people doing really creative things in their bedroom right now that will never perhaps reach an audience or have a fan base. And I think I've been very fortunate in my career. I mean, it's not been easy. It's been a long struggle, you know. But I have somehow managed to achieve a level of success where I do have a fan base, actually being quite selfish about the way I've gone about my career. I guess that's the best answer to your question I can give you.
No, that's a great answer. I recently watched a whole miniseries on Picasso. And people were always trying to get him to paint what they wanted. Because back then, you got paid by painting what somebody wanted. And he never liked that, and eventually just stopped doing it altogether. He said, that's not being an artist.
There are, you know, there are many examples of those kind of individuals in all of the arts. And I think those people sometimes struggle a little bit. Certainly an artist like Van Gogh in his lifetime never sold a painting. Now we consider him to be one of the great masters, you know,
right.
Of art and painting. And I think sometimes that is kind of the sacrifice you make, is that you do run that risk of largely struggling to be recognized for a period of time or perhaps for your whole lifetime. But I think there's something more important, and that is that you can look back at your catalogue and your career and say that you did things from the heart and not to please other people. And that's tough because the industry will pressure you always. You know, again, you mentioned the Picasso, there's always that pressure. There will always be the pressure from the industry to fit the mold, to compromise and to try to produce something which is easy to sell, easy to digest. And it's not easy. It's not easy being an artist, I would say.
I Can agree with that. And we're glad you're still around doing it, so don't stop. Anyway, I have a couple more questions and I'll let you go. I know you're busy.
Sure.
Let's talk a moment about your lyrics, many of which are sad or about dark aspects of society, like the terrorist in Detonation or the serial killer in a favorite song of mine, Blackest Eyes.
Yeah, I think I've always been, you know, it's one of the strangest things to me about not just about my music, but about a lot of the musicians I really admire, a lot of the songwriters I really admire, is there is an attraction to the darker side of life, melancholy and nostalgia, regret, loss. These for me are fascinating subjects, and one of the reasons they're fascinating is because they are shared human experience. We all kind of understand those feelings. We all understand what it means to feel depression, melancholia, anger, regret, loss. All of these things are very familiar to all of us. And one of the beautiful things I think about music and art in general is the ability to hold up a mirror in a kind of comforting way and express those things and say to the listeners, this is my experience, this is what I feel. Do you recognize yourself in the mirror? And that can kind of make the listener understand that they're not alone. And it happened to me very much when I was a kid. You know, like a lot of teenagers, I was going through a lot of angst and not really understanding my place in the world and all this stuff. And one of the great kind of, soothing aspects, I think, for me came from listening to pop music and rock music and understanding that I was not alone in feeling these things. And these things are a shared human emotion. So right now we live in a world which I think we can all agree is problematic, to say the least. So I'm looking around at the world, and like a lot of people who write songs, I'm thinking about the world that I live in. What future does it have? What's going on right now? And I'm finding ways to express that I hope provide some kind of empathy or mirror to the people that listen to my music. I don't write about politics, but what I like to do is write stories, and I write stories from the perspective of individual characters. So, for example, there's a song on the record about the refugee crisis in Europe, and I write that from the perspective of a single, refugee. I write about terrorism, but not in a kind of broad sense. I write about it by using specific characters and stories, which I then tell those stories to kind of illustrate some of my feelings about it. So it's something I've always done that. I've always gravitated towards the darker side of life, I guess. And for me, it's almost like a catharsis, kind of exorcism of those things from my own personality. So I can try to be happy in my life, and you could argue that's a strange thing to do, to, exercise all the negativity out of yourself and give it to your listeners. But I think, strangely, it's also cathartic for them to hear those songs. At least I hope so.
Well, I agree. I play all this music on the radio, and for me, it's a catharsis. It's just playing the music, because I put I put my show together like you would put an album together, and it's therapeutic for me to do that. Anyway, let's skip to another question that has to do with the question I just asked. I recently heard an interview online where you were asked about lyrics, and you mentioned that the lyrics in classic progressive rock songs of the 60s and 70s were inaccessible. What did you mean by that, and who are some of your favorite lyricists?
I don't think progressive rock of the 70s is where you would go to find great lyrics, personally. wasn't what I was interested in. I mean, I do like a lot of 70s conceptual rock music. Not all of it, but some of the bands I do like for sure a lot. But it wasn't the lyrics that interested me. It was definitely the musical innovation.
Yeah.
Growing up, I was very attracted to, in terms of lyrics, to people like Joni Mitchell. And Neil Young and Bob Dylan, more on the singer-songwriter side. So it doesn't necessarily, just because you like a particular kind of music doesn't mean you have to necessarily be inspired by every single aspect of it. I personally never liked the artwork of most 70s progressive rock either. I was never into those kind of fantasy landscapes and things like that. I guess part of me has always been more interested in inner space rather than outer space. I'm more interested in what's going on this planet rather than fantasizing about what might be going on other planets. And you know, again, so it's one of those things that I think if people try and categorize you as doing something, some people want me to tick all these boxes. And I never have and I never will, because that's not the kind of music I want to make, and I would never follow a kind of blueprint either anyway. So I thought Roger Waters' lyrics were great. He always wrote fantastic lyrics, again, very much rooted in, you know, in human existence rather than something more fantastical, and I love that.
Okay. The Telegraph described you last year as, quote, the most successful British musician most people have never heard of. Why do you think that is, and is it due to the enormous amount of music being released today?
It's a combination of things. Certainly, I think, for all the reasons we've already discussed, they don't quite know how to look at me. They don't quite know where to categorize me. And that's a problem, because if you're never part of a particular scene or movement, then you're always kind of on the outside. You're always kind of on the periphery of whatever the latest hype is. Now, I think in the long term, that's been beneficial for me. If you're not on a particular ship when it goes down, then you carry on sailing. And that's kind of the way it's always been for me. I've seen a lot of, you know, movements come and go while I've been making records, and I've kind of just carried on in the slipstream in a way, doing my own thing. And that's continued really until the current day. I still don't get much in terms of radio exposure, TV exposure, press exposure, but I have a very solid fan base, most of whom have found me through word of mouth, you know, people recommending, you know, friends recommending to other friends or whatever, which is a great way to build a following. It just takes a long time, you know. it's like a war of attrition. It takes years and years and years to build out a solid fan base. Without that, you know, media attention, you know, that help from the media, that can make you a global superstar almost overnight if you get the right kind of exposure. I've never had that. You know, it's part of me regrets that because I think it would have been a lot easier. I've never thought of myself as making difficult music. I think my music's quite easy to enjoy. So it's frustrating to me that there has always been this kind of barrier between the music and the potential fan base that there might be out there for what I do.
Right.
So, you know, and there are other reasons too. I think you're right. There is definitely a degree, you know, of simply overload, musical overload these days. It's very hard to get people to engage with an album these days. Most people tend to make up their mind based on 20 seconds of one song. So to get people to listen to an album as kind of musical journey and musical continuum, and certainly my albums are, much like you were talking about your shows, very much planned as a kind of a musical journey and a trip, you know. So how do you get people who have no attention span to sit down and engage with music on that level? It's tough, and it's getting tougher and tougher every year.
Yeah. So let's chat for a moment about your famous remixes, which I think just hit 50 albums, by the likes of King Crimson, Jethro Tull, Hawkwind, XTC, Yes, Gentle Giant, Tears for Fears, Chicago, Rush, and others. Obvious question, how do you find the time to do all this and still tour and write and record albums?
Well, you know, the simple answer is I don't anymore. I mean, I'm actually doing a lot less of that than I was. To the Bone has been a successful record for me, thankfully, very thankful for that. But one of the downsides of that is that I hadn't had the time to do as much extracurricular activity as I was doing 3 or 4 years ago. It's a labor of love doing these things. I don't take on a project unless I really, really love the album in question. Still to this day, if you know, even though I've protested that I'm too busy, if I suddenly got a call tomorrow from, the David Bowie estate or Kate Bush's or, you know, or the Beatles estate, of course I would find the time, you know. But I think I'm being a little bit more selective about what I do. It does seem like a lot, but I guess you have to bear in mind that's those 50 albums have been done over a 10-year period. So I guess I've had a pretty good average until now. But I am slowing down a little bit by necessity, yeah.
Okay, now you've been around the world several times on many tours. In fact, you just returned to North America from New Zealand. How is the To the Bone tour going, and how is the audience different from other tours you've done?
It really depends on so much on the country. There are certain countries, I think, where the audience is a bit like me. You know, they're kind of certain age, male, musical nerds. And that's great. I love playing to those kind of audiences. America would be one of those places where the audience tends to be the more obsessive music fans. And then, for example, we were in India, we were in South America, places like Chile, places like Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, where the audience is all kids. And, you know, I think a lot of what we've been talking about, if the music is largely invisible in the mainstream, then you don't tend to reach a broader audience. You tend to reach a more, what you would call, a cult audience. And if your music does get played on the radio and you do get some mainstream exposure, you tend to have a much wider demographic. And, of course, I'm very happy to play to either scenario, but I'm always looking, in a way, to try to broaden the audience. I think certainly To the Bone, I've seen it broaden out a lot more than at any other time in my career. I've got a lot more women now. I think probably 25-30% of the audience is women now, which is a big change. I remember in the last days of Porcupine Tree, it was 100% male. And now it's probably 25-30% women, which is great. Who doesn't want women at their show? And, you know, it's a real, sometimes it's a real mixture of, you know, whole families, you know, young kids and mum and dad. And I still get some metal fans coming along to my show. I get kids in Radiohead T-shirts. I get older guys in Yes T-shirt, Nine Inch Nails. It's really interesting to look out and see the T-shirts every night. So that kind of tells me a lot about the, you know, the demographic of the audience. So it's been probably more varied. It's more varied on this tour than it's ever been before, which is great because that tells me that the music is somehow it's transcending that, you know, that kind of idea of genre and a particular type of listener, which, you know, going right back to the beginning of our conversation, is exactly what I want.
Right. Okay, one last question before I let you go.
Yeah.
Has your career turned out the way you expected? And if not, what would you change?
No, it hasn't turned out the way I expected. I wouldn't say I would change anything, but you have to understand, when I started, the music industry was a completely different thing. It was a completely different beast to what it is now. The music industry has changed beyond recognition since I started. But when I started, it was in the early 90s, and it was still very much the kind of roots to having a career in the music industry was still very much the thing where you get together, you form a band, you write some songs, you make a demo, you get a record deal, you release your first record, you get press, you go into it, and all that stuff. And now you cannot do that. A record company won't even touch you until you've proved yourself. So it's almost like you're in this catch-22 situation. Hmm. You almost have to build an audience before a record company will even look at you. Hmm. And that's completely changed the whole nature of the industry. In some ways, for the better, because I think it means that there are a lot of musicians out there now that have realized there's no point in trying to write commercial music. They should just do what they do and, you know, kind of emphasize what's different rather than try and cater for what they think, you know, the larger commercial music industry expects from them. So that's good in a way. I think there's a lot more interesting and experimental music out there now, but you really have to search for it. And that gets harder and harder as we talked about this incredible proliferation of too much music, too much noise. How do you find the quality stuff? So when I was a kid, my hero was Prince. You know, I wanted to be Prince. But you can laugh, but I wanted to be that kind of old school. I had this old school idea of being a pop star in my head, like a lot of, you know, like a lot of teenage kids. And I'm not even sure it's possible to be a pop star in that way anymore. In other words, someone that has a massive mainstream profile is very commercial in one sense, but also very kind of willful and experimental in another way. you could look at the Beatles in the 60s as being an example of that. You could look at Bowie in the 70s as being an example of that. And you can look at someone like Prince or Peter Gabriel in the 80s as being examples of that. In other words, being both accessible and experimental in a way. And I don't think it's possible to really do that now in the 21st century. It's just too hard. So what I kind of imagined myself being in the future when I was a kid, simply that kind of model does not exist in 2018.
Right.
But you know what? I'm happy with the way my career's been. You asked me if there's anything I'd change. I don't think so, because I have a very loyal audience, and I do pretty much what I do without compromise. And as I said earlier, very selfish, kind of in the way I go about my music, which I think, as you say, is kind of the way my friends, at least I hope that's what they appreciate about me, that I don't, I don't try and please them. I do my own thing, and I do it without that sense of compromise. So I wouldn't change, anything in that respect.
Okay. Well, Stephen, thanks for coming on Nonprofit Community Radio via telephone. We appreciate your support of independent radio, and I want to thank you for visiting with me on the world-famous Closer to the Edge. We'll see you in Asheville in a couple weeks.
Fantastic. Look forward to it. Nice speaking to you, too. Cheers, man.
All right, folks. We are now going to hear one of the greatest rock compositions ever recorded. That's right. Originally on Stephen Wilson's 2015 concept album, Hand Cannot Erase, here is the newest live version of Ancestral, all the way from Home Invasion in concert at the Royal Albert Hall, to you on listener-supported radio in Asheville and beyond.